Drug companies reach a $260 million settlement over the opioid crisis, avoiding trial. U.S. troops withdrawing from Syria are met with scorn from civilians in Kurdish areas. And the Islamic State turns to TikTok in an attempt to appeal to teens.
Experts say that the overall amount of propaganda coming out of ISIS has actually declined, but this could be a way for them to try to reestablish a bulkhead on a platform where teens are spending a lot of time.
It's Monday, October 21st. This is the PM edition of What's News from The Wall Street Journal. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli in New York. Civilians in Kurdish areas of Syria and Iraq showed open hostility towards a convoy of U.S. forces withdrawing from northern Syria early Monday. Our Suna Engel Rasmussen followed the troops as they moved into northern Iraq.
They were met with quite a lot of abuse, actually, on the Syrian side at least, where people pelted fruit and vegetables after them and cursed them. People in Iraq cursed them as well. And the reason that there's such strong reactions to the U.S. withdrawal from Syria is that the U.S. forces were the main ally of the Kurds, and the Syrian Kurds were sort of the most reliable partner for the U.S. in the fight against ISIS in Syria. So the Kurds feel betrayed by the U.S., and they feel like the U.S. leaves without leaving them a proper plan for autonomy, which they were striving towards, but also more basically for their survival in Syria.
The Kurds' anger could complicate future U.S. operations in the region, including efforts to prevent a resurgence of Islamic State and maintain control over Syria's oil fields. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper says the U.S. troops will combat ISIS from western Iraq. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's failed to form a government, leaving it open for his political rival to potentially take over power. After the country's election in September failed to deliver a clear winner, Israeli President Reuven Rivlin gave Netanyahu the first shot at trying to create a ruling coalition. Now Netanyahu's rival Benny Gantz will have 28 days to form a majority that would end Netanyahu's tenure as the country's longest-serving premier. But Gantz will also face the same political deadlock as Netanyahu. More guilty pleas from some high-profile parents implicated in a wide-ranging college admissions cheating scandal. So far, 19 of the 35 parents charged have pleaded guilty or say they plan to do so. The government is expected to bring new charges as early as Tuesday against those who haven't. But those entering guilty pleas today could be in for tougher punishments than other parents before them, since they're facing conspiracy charges linked to fraud and money laundering. College consultant and confessed ringleader William Rick Singer has pleaded guilty to running a $25 million scheme to rig test scores and bribe college coaches. President Trump's two picks for Homeland Security Secretary aren't eligible for the job. We report that the White House personnel director has told Trump neither Ken Cuccinelli nor Mark Morgan, both of whom have only worked for DHS for the past few months, are qualified under the federal vacancies law. Both men support the president's immigration policies. Acting Secretary Kevin McAleenan has resigned but will remain on the job until the end of the month. British Parliament is set to vote on Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Brexit plan on Tuesday. Johnson secured the deal with the European Union last week, but victory is far from certain. Lawmakers will take a straight yes or no vote on the plan on Tuesday, but even if it passes, the deal is still subject to a number of parliamentary votes that could upend or delay it. Johnson has vowed to exit the EU by October 31st, but his opponents say the deadline doesn't give them enough time. Four companies, McKesson, Cardinal Health, AmerisourceBergen, and Teva, have reached a last-minute settlement to avoid trial on charges of fueling the opioid crisis. Together, the companies agreed to pay $260 million to settle claims brought by two Ohio counties. Joining me now via Skype from Cleveland, Ohio, with more details is The Wall Street Journal's Sarah Randazzo. Sarah, this settlement was being negotiated into the early morning hours on Sunday. Can you tell us the details of the settlement between these drug companies and the plaintiffs?
Yeah, so we were coming to court Monday morning expecting to see a trial with five defendants, but instead we heard that four of them reached settlements. And so three of those, the three big distributors, McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen, are collectively going to pay $215 million to avoid the trial. And then another company, Teva Pharmaceutical Industries, which makes generic drugs, is giving $20 million in cash over a number of years and donating $25 million in addiction treatment drugs.
Do we have any other details about how the settlement money will be used? A portion of it, as you mentioned, is going to rehabilitation facilities. What about the rest?
Yeah, so the counties have made clear that they want this money to go directly toward fixing and abating the opioid crisis. And so people asked them after court, you know, this won't just go toward balancing your budget, will it? And they insisted, no, this money is to help people in need. It'll probably go toward programs like treatment centers and helping first responders and areas that have borne some of the costs of dealing with opioid addiction. And so both the companies and the counties made clear today that this money is intended to go toward helping the problem.
Were drug companies required to admit to any wrongdoing as part of the settlement?
They were not. And one of the plaintiff's lawyers after court was asked about this, and he said, basically said, you know, well, the way things go in these, you can get the money, but it's hard to get an admission of wrongdoing when the companies still face hundreds and thousands of other lawsuits. It's just not something they're going to do. So, you know, the money is the big thing that's going to help, but if anyone wanted to see an admission of wrongdoing, it's not in these deals.
So put this settlement in context for us. This is a settlement, as you said, between four companies and two Ohio counties. There are still thousands of other lawsuits.
That's right. So this trial, there had been quite a lot of attention on it because it was the first big bellwether trial, as they call it here in federal court in Cleveland. But really, it was only specifically in the cases of these two Ohio counties. So these two counties' cases took on a bit of an outsized importance in that regard. But so the settlement really only resolves with those two counties, but there's still, as you say, hundreds and thousands of other lawsuits brought by both local governments as well as state attorneys general. And so basically what happens now is that settlement talks will continue on what they're calling a global resolution, which is something that would resolve all of the opioid cases for a far greater deal of money beyond just these two counties.
And we know, and as you've explained, there is extensive, unprecedented litigation over the opioid crisis. Could the deal reached today serve as a framework for resolving those other lawsuits? What comes next here?
Yeah, so that's what everyone always wants to look at and say, okay, well, you got $215 million here. What does that mean for everyone else? But the lawyers made clear after court and just thinking about it, it seems like it won't be directly applicable in that you can't multiply $215 by every county in the country and get what the ultimate dollar value might be. Whenever there's a trial, it really puts different pressures on things and can force a lot more money out of companies. And so it's a framework in the sense that companies were willing to come to the table and reach a deal to help get money toward abating the opioid epidemic. But in terms of the pure dollar value, it's still hard to say what the overall settlement might look like.
That's the Wall Street Journal's Sarah Randazzo joining us via Skype from Cleveland. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thanks so much.
The social media network TikTok is popular among teens, but they're not the only ones using it. Islamic State militants have also been posting short propaganda videos on TikTok. The social media intelligence company Storyful, which is owned by the Wall Street Journal parent company News Corp, found posts from about two dozen accounts that appeared to target the app's users. TikTok's owner, ByteDance, has removed the posts and hired thousands of moderators to help curate its content. Joining me now via Skype from our Tech Live conference in Laguna Beach, California, to discuss this is the Wall Street Journal's Georgia Wells. Georgia, what were you able to find out about the type of content ISIS was posting to TikTok? Was it aimed primarily at recruitment?
So the content that ISIS was posting really ran the gamut from quite violent content of like corpses being paraded through streets to lighter fare with hearts and stars. And overall, experts say that this likely is both aimed at recruitment and also rousing enthusiasm for their cause and a way to attempt to signal their continued relevance and indicate they're still here, even at a time when the amount of propaganda coming out of their organization is declining and the amount of land they control is also declining.
Georgia, what else do experts say about these tactics?
Experts say that these tactics are a lot more effective at kind of resonating with younger people than traditional sermons or preaching at people. This is a way of engaging with young people where they're hanging out.
Georgia, what does this tell us about ISIS's reach? A big concern now is that the withdrawal of U.S. troops in Syria will allow ISIS to rebuild. What can ISIS's presence on online platforms like TikTok tell us about that?
Experts say that the overall amount of propaganda coming out of ISIS has actually declined, but this could be a way for them to try to like reestablish a bulkhead on a platform where teens are spending a lot of time. So it's an attempt to be like, you know, despite the news, we're still here.
How is TikTok cracking down on this? It's not the only social media company that is facing challenges like this.
Yeah. So TikTok prohibits any content from terrorist or extremist organizations. It has no tolerance for this. As soon as we flagged some videos to them, they took them down and banned the accounts and the devices that they banned the devices from ever joining TikTok again. And they also proactively have banned some other accounts. Facebook and Twitter have also dealt with this in the past. They appear to, you know, have a little bit more experience with identifying these types of videos, which could be why those videos are now harder to find on the other platforms. Bad actors posting negative content on the platforms is something that every social media network has or will face during its lifespan.
That's The Wall Street Journal's Georgia Wells joining us via Skype from The Wall Street Journal's Tech Live Conference in Laguna Beach, California. Thanks, Georgia.
Thank you.
TikTok was the third most installed app worldwide in the first quarter, behind Facebook's WhatsApp and Messenger. According to the company, about 30% of its users are under the age of 18. For more on this story, please head to our website, WSJ.com, or the WSJ app. And that's what's news for this Monday afternoon. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.